Welcome to Encounter on ABC Radio National. I'm Masako Fukui. In today's program, we'll be exploring the meaning of pain, but a kind of pain that most of us are unlikely to experience. Intense physical pain in the context of a religious ritual.
They go into a trance and then they're pierced with needles, with hooks, with spears. Some of them even drag chariots.
It was like being in the hell realms. It was like just intense kind of pain. But the more focused I became, it became more effortless. And these are bliss states.
All religions that I know actually use pain, but it has to be ritualized pain. It can't be just brutality. Pain is unique in having that kind of a power to diminish the sense of self.
Well, I think it depends what you do with the pain, and childbirth is a source of great pain, but if we were to remove that conditioning and say that it could even be pleasurable, then that creates a whole lot of other expectations of childbirth, and many women have had pleasurable experiences and absolutely no pain in childbirth.
The central issue for all religious thought is pain and suffering. There are almost as many views on pain and suffering as there are religious traditions, but common to nearly all of them are rituals involving intense physical pain. Misrepresentations of religious pain, like in the popular film The Da Vinci Code, have given it a bad public image, but meaningful practices still exist. For example, there's the Shia Muslim ritual of self-flagellation, commemorating the death of Hussein, Muhammad's grandson, and on the last Sunday in July, some Irish Catholics honour St. Patrick with a barefoot pilgrimage to the top of Rocky Mount Kirkpatrick. So how is pain used in religion? What are the psychological, emotional, neurological processes associated with intense pain? And how can these be used to help us attain religious goals like self-world transcendence, enlightenment, spiritual fortification? Exploring these questions won't hurt. In fact, we'll discover that pain can be a desirable pathway to the sacred or divine. And if religious ecstasy is possible through pain, embracing other kinds of pain, like labour pain, can also lead to ecstatic, maybe even orgasmic, childbirth.
My name's Lynn Haley. I'm the Clinical Services Coordinator of the Pain Management Unit at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, and I'm also the State Counsellor for the Australian Pain Society.
And because you're a medical person, I wanted to get a working definition of pain from you.
There's the International Association for the Study of Pain's definition. It's a sensory and emotional experience associated with real or potential tissue damage and described in terms of such damage. The main thing is that it is always subjective, and as a nurse, pain is what the patient says hurts.
But you said it's a subjective experience. So how do you evaluate it? If somebody comes to you and says, "I'm in a lot of pain," how do you know that it is a lot of pain compared to somebody else?
If I'm rating my pain lower, I might be in a better place emotionally than the person next door to me. I may have someone who's looking after my children at home. It wasn't an unexpected surgery, so I've had time to plan things. Whereas the person in the bed next to me, their surgery may have been an emergency procedure where the children, who's going to pick them up after school, there are all these other things can have an impact on the sensation of pain.
Pain is a much more complex issue than just rating of 2 out of 10 or whatever, you have to be aware of what's going on with that patient.
That's right.
Various approaches to pain in pain clinics and hospitals show that pain is never just in the body. It's in the body, the mind, the family, your whole life, actually.
Ariel Gluklich is professor of theology at Georgetown University in the US and author of Sacred Pain, Hurting the Body for the Sake of the Soul. His book investigates this complex interplay of biology and culture that gives pain its subjectivity or meaning, including religious meaning. At the core of his thesis is the idea that these religious meanings depend on the human ability to empathize with another's pain. Without this ability to share pain, the Passion of Christ, for example, would have little symbolic value.
In a sense, we have evolved as a species, as a social group, and we communicate pain non-verbally and in other ways. Even artistically, we're not completely in a private world of pain. You see it in art representation, in the way a line is portrayed as jagged, and that will somehow correspond to how we feel pain as being rupturing, or perhaps it feels jagged in the body as it moves through, sort of like a saw. So there's all these metaphors for representing pain, and people get it. You don't obviously feel pain in your body, but you empathetically feel the suffering of that person.
And are these metaphors universal?
Yes. When the metaphors are verbal, for example, you will find them in Sanskrit, in Hebrew, biblical Hebrew. You find it in contemporary English, in Arabic. Terms that describe the pain in such ways as piercing or burning or throbbing. Those words are in every culture, and even cultures that probably didn't interact at the time that these words were used.
Why do they have to be expressed as metaphors?
What the pain feels like to us when we say that it is throbbing or burning, it corresponds to certain kind of neurological events, and those events have certain kind of structure. It's not arbitrary, and it's not just somehow invented. That's the nature of the feel.
These structures defining the nature of felt pain are neurological structures. Most of us have never been pierced or stabbed in the head, yet we still describe a headache as piercing or stabbing, because that's the actual neurological form that the headache takes. The metaphors then are biologically determined, making pain unique among human sensations. Pain is always painful. In Professor Gluklich's model, pain starts at biology. But what makes pain an individual experience depends on how it's interpreted by the emotional, cognitive, and socio-cultural context. If there's a religious context, the pain can take on religious meaning. This model is certainly not the only model of pain, but it does explain how mystics throughout time have been able to imbue pain with religious subjectivity.
I suspect that at some point in the history of religions, it was discovered that manipulating pain ritually can produce certain states of consciousness which build on that shareability or communicability of pain. What I mean by that is if you manipulate pain within a ritual, then you can sort of close the gap between the person who's experiencing the pain and the goal of the ritual. Pain has a certain kind of neurodynamic consequences, namely you're flooding the body with incoming uncomfortable information. The more of that kind of information comes in, the more the output gets diminished. And the sense of individual self also becomes diminished.
So the pain doesn't actually shut out the world. It actually breaks down your sense of identity.
Exactly, exactly. Pain is all about bombarding yourself with external stimulation. It's sort of hyperstimulation, if you will, and it has these amazing psychological consequences. If you take somebody and you bombard his or her body with that kind of information against their will, say in torture, think of the Gestapo or what have you, then you can cause a total psychotic breakdown where the sense of individuality is shattered. That's a great tragedy. But if a person does this voluntarily, the very same breakdown of the individual self is no longer a tragedy. Instead, as the self is dismantled, something else gets built up. So if you're focusing on Shiva as you were hurting, and by the way, you can think of, say, a Catholic nun doing the very same thing with Jesus. As that happens, you come to think of yourself not as Jack or Joe, but as Jesus himself or as Murugan himself. So building the object of devotion and undermining subjectivity.
So there has to be present a motive or a goal of the pain, and there has to be present some kind of, in this case, religious context.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to have a dear, deeply held value, a sacred goal, such as the sacred community or God or gods or something like that. So a sacred pain is a bridge to sacred realities.
O flame of love, so living, how tenderly you force to my soul's inmost core your fiery probe. Since now you've no misgiving, end it. Pursue your course, and for our sweet encounter, tear the robe. O cautery most tender, O gash that is my guerdon, O gentle hand, O touch how softly thrilling, eternal life you render, raise of all debts the burden, and change my death to life, even while killing.
You're listening to Encounter on ABC Radio National, and today we're exploring the role of pain in religion. This excerpt from The Living Flame of Love, a poem by 16th century Carmelite mystic St. John of the Cross, exults in the union with God that comes at the climax of much pain and suffering. But such union is not always the result of ritually manipulated pain that Professor Gluklich describes. In fact, St. John's use of pain was more nuanced, according to Sarah Coakley, Norris House Professor of Divinity at the University of Cambridge in the UK. In a recently released book, Pain and Its Transformations, in which she discusses the lives of Carmelite mystics St. John and St. Teresa of Avila, she proposes a rather different view of pain in the religious context.
The imposition of pain has been a feature of the use of the penance, for instance, in monastic tradition in Christianity, but is rather frowned upon nowadays, and not without good reason, I think, because that suggests a kind of manipulative use of pain for religious purposes, which is not really what I want to talk about. I'm much more interested myself in those kinds of pains, both spiritual and physical, that come whether we seek them or not. And none of us can avoid these in life. So it's the kind of pains which are not completely obliterating and yet somewhat continuous, which I think are peculiarly capable of being reflected on religiously and maybe put into some context of religious meaning. And then the interesting question is this pain that I have either in my body or my soul or in both something that is part of the divine plan for me? How do I respond to it? How could it perhaps be something which is a means of proceeding through to a deeper closeness to God in Christ. And in the case of some of the most exalted literature of mystical theology, especially that of the 16th century Carmelites, there is very subtle and rich reflection on how different kinds of pain may be significant for spiritual advance, ultimately towards union with Christ.
So can you explain union with Christ and how pain is instrumental in that?
What's very distinctive about John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila is that they see an unbroken intimacy with Christ as something that can happen to at least a few specially chosen people in this life. And in the case of John of the Cross, this union is expressed mainly in the language of erotic delight in the spiritual canticle and the living flame of love. But it's very important to underscore that this is not the physiological eroticism that we are all familiar with. It is an eroticism that arises out of long years of purgation and transformation of the physiological life to be in accordance with the spiritual. And fascinatingly enough, even as John talks about the unbroken erotic consummation of love with Christ, he's also at the same time talking about this union as a form of cautery or wound. It's a wound of love, as he puts it. It bespeaks that utter unification of the soul with the what you might call the redemptive project of Christ, which of course involves suffering as well as resurrection and transformation.
So is there something that the narrative tells us about pain and how we can use pain?
I certainly think there is, and I think if we accept that some pains can't be obliterated, then we are on the way to reflecting on how it could be that at least some pain is potentially a means of such spiritual transformation. Then I think we can begin to think of meditation, contemplation, ritual enactment, reflection on the narratives of the gospel, not simply as things that may ameliorate our sense of affliction immediately, but undertakings which are transformative in themselves because they draw us closer to God. They're not, as it were, tools that we can manipulate, but they are means to a possible transformation of consciousness and even physiological awareness.
I saw in his hands a large golden dart, and at the end of the iron tip there appeared to be a little fire. It seemed to me that this angel plunged the dart several times into my heart and that it reached deep within me. When he drew it out, I thought he was carrying off with him the deepest part of me, and he left me all on fire with great love of God. The pain was so great that it made me moan, and the sweetness this greatest pain caused me was so abundant that there is no desire capable of taking it away. Nor is the soul content with less than God.
This excerpt from St. Teresa's autobiography was the inspiration for the famous sculpture, The Ecstasy of St. Teresa, by Italian artist Gian Lorenzo Bernini. While Teresa's ecstasy is often misread in secular culture as S&M, according to Professor Sarah Coakley, it's important to note that her pain is suffered for a higher goal, making her ecstasy a religious experience. So as the pain transforms into ecstasy, the self in this case Teresa's soul, is also remade into a sacred bond with God. And this power to transform the self is what makes pain valuable to religion. In a secular society too, intense pain, like labour pain, is highly valued for similar reasons. And we'll come back to this later in the program. While pain can be a bridge to sacred realities, this goal is particular to religions like Christianity and Islam, where there's a conceptual gap between the self and God. In Eastern religions, such as Hinduism or Buddhism, where there's no existential gap between the divine and humans, pain is used to attain other religious goals. Here's Pandit Rami Sivan of the Australian Council of Hindu Clergy.
Hinduism begins its analysis of the human condition from the point of view of a general term for suffering known as dukkha. And it encompasses all manner of suffering, including physical pain, mental pain, and pain from the gods, which would be tempests, storms. And everybody, by default, is in a state of dukkha, or state of suffering. Pain and pleasure are seen as opposites. Neither of them are absolute. And I do emphasize that pleasure is just as much part of the conditioned existence as pain. One of our seminal texts is the Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna says that the spiritual aspirant should aspire to be free from both pleasure and pain. Because pleasure and pain are mental states. They're not really objective states externally. So all our spiritual practice is about getting to a place of equanimity where we're no longer affected either by pleasure or by pain. But because our default condition already is some sort of pain, that then becomes the vehicle for our very transcendence of pain itself.
And how do you get there? What are the practices?
There would be practices like lying on beds of nails. Monks, for example, sleep on the floor. They don't use pillows, they use a block of wood. There are certain yogic practices in which one actually sits naked in the snow, and through certain yogic breathing exercises, one generates an internal heat enough to melt the snow. And in that process, obviously, there's overcoming of the pain of the cold. Then we have certain festivals, like fire walking, that are particularly popular in South India, where people, as part of their vows to one of the gods or goddesses, undertake to endure what would be severe pain. There is a fasting period, and on the day they go into a trance, and then they're pierced with needles, with hooks, with spears. Some of them even drag chariots. But at the time, they do not actually experience the pain. And the trance process is a self-generated state of mind in which you simply go beyond the pain. It doesn't affect you anymore. And so you can walk on fire. And the mind state is such that the body doesn't even very often register blisters or any kind of burning. One of the most famous examples is a saint called Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, who was dying of throat cancer. But he never evinced any physical pain. And one of his devotees said to him, "Master, I can't bear to see you in this condition. Please transfer the pain to me." So he said, "I can't do that to any sentient being because the pain is so great." And he said, "Well, but I'll transfer it to a tree." And allegedly he transferred the pain to a tree and the tree burst into flame. So obviously the pain was there. He simply disassociated from the pain completely.
In these practices described by Rami Sivan, it's the awareness or the cognition of pain that the Hindu practitioner strives to transcend. Pain also exists in Buddhist meditative practice, but the goal here is not to transcend, but to embrace pain. Subhana Bazagi is a Zen Buddhist Roshi, or senior teacher.
There is a certain degree of pain that arises in meditation when you sit for long hours of meditation, particularly on a retreat. One is sitting for often up to 8 hours a day. It's a kind of very intense thing to do, and my whole body was on fire. It was like being in the hell realms. It was like just intense kind of pain. But I was practicing concentration on the breath, single-pointed attention. And the more deeply you concentrate, the mind became very, very steady. And in fact, the more focused I became, it became more effortless. And therefore, you enter into what's called deep samadhi concentration states. And these are bliss states. So my experience actually was, at times, hanging out in bliss. And the next moment, however, if my mind wandered off the focus of attention, suddenly I was in hell. I was in this fierce pain in the body. And so there was an incentive, of course, naturally, to concentrate. So one would hang out in bliss. But what I noticed in there, that was a single thought could either produce heaven or hell. And so it was a very interesting working with intense pain. I had to work through an enormous amount of fear as well that comes up and thinks, oh gosh, I'm going to be a cripple, I'm never going to walk again. All these kind of ideas, which aren't true. They're just the scary kind of, you know, thoughts in the mind largely. And so in meditation we have an opportunity to look deeply into that which is unpleasant. So there's a lot in just dealing with the pain in sitting. Your relationship to the pain is what's under investigation. Not that pain should be there or not be there. Some people say, well, why would I want to focus on pain? Why do that? Isn't that some kind of masochistic process? And no. There's a certain degree that we focus on the pain or focus on the relationship we have to the pain. Yeah. This is what's important, is the relationship, our attitude of mind. Because the same way that you react to a pain in the knee is often that same attitude that we bring to a painful person, difficult situation, for example. In some sense, there's no such thing as actually just a physical pain. What you start to discover is that we have an emotional, psychological layer or story around every pain in our body. Yeah? Pain is a wise yet harsh teacher.
When I go to the dentist, I do recite mantra, and I do manage in most cases to transcend the pain, but I still like to have a bit of an injection.
Don't we all?
As you get older, physical pain is a part of everyday existence. And the spiritual practice recognizes that's an inevitable, but the identification with that pain distracts your mind from your spiritual practice. From a Hindu perspective, we are not the body. The body is a vehicle. Now, there is already this separation between the self, which is the conscious part of the being, and the mind-body. So the idea would be to perfectly control the mind-body by the application of certain techniques. Jai Jai Karunathe Shri Mahadeva Shambho.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Encounter. In the human experience of pain, there's a somatic dimension and an interpretive dimension, or the meaning we ascribe to the somatic pain. In Hindu and Buddhist spiritual practice, the goal is to contemplate, understand, reflect upon the interpretive dimension of pain, imbuing it with religious meaning so that the somatic pain no longer causes suffering. But one of the great mysteries and major controversies in every religion that uses pain, especially self-inflicted pain, is how to decipher what the pain is telling us. In fact, is there any way of knowing whether a devout nun who wears a corset of nails or a mystic who pierces his body with knives is hurting religiously or just plain crazy? Professor Ariel Gluklich of Georgetown University and author of Sacred Pain.
It's a question that the church has actually wrestled with even before the concept of psychopathology emerged in the 19th century, where, say, one's supervisors in the monastery had to monitor the behavior of nuns or monks to make sure that their ascetic behaviors are not the result of some kind of pathological symptom. So the church was aware that there was a difference between extreme devotion and masochistic inclinations, but they couldn't really draw the line very clearly. And I'm sure they messed up often. And you had individuals who seemed to be very, very devoted, but were actually trying to run away from problems or what have you. Even today, the boundary line between pathology and extreme devotion isn't always clear. So you have people today who suspend themselves on hooks, body modification, piercings, tattooing. They describe it as being very powerful and wonderful. So where exactly do you draw the line?
Unless we have a sure spiritual guide, someone who can discern the signs, it is very difficult to know at any given time whether the pains that we feel really are purgative and transformative, or whether they are signs that we are off the road. And that's part of the mystery of what one is undertaking. One can't manipulate this in a way that has complete control, precisely because one is handing over control by progressive degrees to God.
Professor Sarah Coakley of the University of Cambridge.
Now, I have to tell you that after I wrote Sacred Pain, over the years I've gotten dozens of emails from mostly young women who are cutters. Oh. And they take razor blades and cut very often upper thigh and places like that. And that's regarded as certainly pathology. You don't want your teenage daughter cutting yourself, right? But they would write to me emails saying that they didn't want to cut themselves, but the cutting made them feel better. It made them feel empowered. And the book gave them a context for how to think about why it is that an unwanted act actually had rather positive consequences.
The idea that self-mutilation might be empowering, or indeed that any pain could be a positive experience, might seem radical. But it's only in the mid-19th century that anaesthetics became available, and until then, pain was not only inescapable, but had a role in our lives. Undoubtedly, painkillers have given us quality of life. But was something lost when medical science began obliterating pain?
Pain has meanings, okay? And that the meanings of pain is related to the fact that we did, in pre-modern times, exist in communities, and our sense of identity was tied up with the communities and with the invention of anesthetics in the 1840s, part of a process that cut us away from that sense of community, turned us into medical individuals, into bodies. And so now what we lost was the fact that the signals coming from the body are not just biological signals, but they are also social signals too. So that social signaling of pain is what we have lost.
What happened to pain? Why don't we see pain as just another human experience?
I think we've focused on killing pain, painkillers, and you know, they've sort of permeated right through our culture that pain is always a bad thing and we need to kill it or get rid of it somehow. I think generally with the progress of medicine, we've come to see not just pain but suffering and death and all of those things as things that we can potentially get rid of. And I think that it makes our culture poorer for it because, you know, when we try and obliterate suffering, we can end up obliterating pleasure as well.
Dr. Sarah Buckley is a general practitioner based in Brisbane. She's a strong advocate of natural birthing, a controversial topic that divides medical professionals and women. But as a feminist doctor and birthing specialist, she encourages the full experience of labour pain because this produces ecstatic birthing hormones, which help transform the pain into ecstasy.
The four hormones that I talk about, there's obviously many more, and that oxytocin, which is known as the hormone of love, beta endorphin, which I call hormone of pleasure and transcendence, adrenaline and noradrenaline, which are hormones of excitement, and the last hormone is prolactin, a major hormone of breastfeeding, but also I call it the hormone of tender mothering, because all of these hormones have major psycho-emotional effects, and all of these hormones are actually hormones of social interaction as well, and that's obviously optimal because that's what's happening during labor and birth. It's not just about the mother pushing the baby out. It's about the mother forming this incredibly strong and intimate bond with her baby so that she will do all the things that are necessary for the survival of her baby because that's also survival of the species. Oxytocin, we know, has an intrinsic pain-relieving effect as well as being the hormone that causes the contractions of pain, so that's sort of useful. And beta-endorphin is the body's natural opiate. It's the natural equivalent to pethidine and morphine. But I also call it a hormone of transcendence because how I describe it is it puts women into an altered state of consciousness that helps her to deal with the stress and pain of labour. And I mean, the question is, do we want to completely abolish labour pain? Because it does have some purposes as well. Birth is a very powerful cultural initiation. You know, most cultures have some sort of process that she goes through on the way to having a baby. I mean, it may be something that happens during pregnancy. I mean, we have a baby shower, for example. But also during labour and birth, I mean, how much is that woman able to express her own power as a woman? Because that's part of the process of labour and birth, you know, the ecstatic hormones, when I believe that the function of them is that the woman comes out not just with a baby but as a mother, and many cultures acknowledge that, but you could say our culture does the opposite. We actually take away the woman's power.
So the cultural aspects in our Western culture that medicalises birth, does that take away the effect of those pleasure hormones that you talk about?
Oh, exactly. And I document in my work exactly what happens to each of those hormones with various interventions. And, for example, when we take opiate drugs, when we use pethidine in labour, the body reduces its own natural opiates, its own beta endorphin, because it figures, you know, there's enough of this hormone here. A cesarean, obviously, too, when a woman has a cesarean, she doesn't go through that process of releasing those vast quantities of hormones of love and pleasure and excitement and tenderness. And all of these hormones are there to help us to transcend the stress and pain of labour.
So maybe you can talk about your experience of ecstatic birth. How can labour pain, which many people say is excruciating, how can that turn into ecstasy?
Well, I think it depends what you do with the pain. And I'll just describe, for example, what I did with my fourth baby. I had a very ecstatic experience there, and it was really what came to me instinctively in this altered state of consciousness. I used oxytocin, you could say. I found my partner. I looked into his eyes as I was having each wave of labour, and I said, I love you, 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 just peaking with each contraction. And that totally transmuted that pain that I might have had into something completely different, an experience of ecstasy, of love, of being totally consumed by oxytocin or love, if you like, in that experience.
I've read in literature that you've written and other people have written about ecstatic birthing, that there's a transcendence, or there's a change of identity, I suppose, which is not dissimilar to some of the experiences that religious mystics say they have when they self-inflict pain. Would you say it's a similar physiological and mental process?
My guess is that it would be, and you know, some of the yogis as well, they'll meditate in very painful positions on beds of nails, for example, and maybe they're just increasing their beta endorphin, which can help to transmute that pain into pleasure, and you know, very high levels of beta endorphin can be transcendent and pleasurable and ecstatic.
Which brings us to orgasmic birthing. How does that work?
Well, it's no accident, really, that orgasm can happen during childbirth, because childbirth is actually a sexual event. I think we've tried to totally erase the sexuality out of childbirth. One of the childbirth gurus, Anime Gaskin, says it's the energy that gets the baby in can help the baby to come out. And it's that part of a woman's body that is the sexual part of her body. And the hormones that we release, all of those hormones that I talk about, are actually exactly the hormones and exactly the pattern of release during sexual activity. And during orgasm, there's an outpouring of oxytocin. Also an outpouring of the fight or flight hormones, adrenaline and noradrenaline. So the hormonal processes are very similar. So orgasmic birth can be a deliberate orgasm during birth, and women have used that as a way of not just pain relief, because they're augmenting their oxytocin, beta endorphin, those pain-killing hormones, but also through encouraging contractions of the uterus, it can make childbirth very rapid. And but the other way of talking about orgasmic birth is spontaneous, or we might call it a blessed orgasm that happens during birth, and that has happened for quite a few women spontaneously as their baby came out. That stimulation of their vagina, that peak of the birthing hormones, can actually cause what I'm told, I haven't experienced it myself, is one of the best orgasms that one could ever have.
It is written in the Bible, in Genesis, in fact, that women are supposed to have pain in childbirth.
First of all, about that particular biblical quote, it's very controversial, because apparently it hinges on the translation of one word, and that word, which has been translated in most Bibles as pain, actually in other parts of the Bible is apparently translated as work or labour. So it could be saying, with work you will have your babies. That is one particular religious view of childbirth, and my understanding is that other religions, previous matriarchal religions, have held childbirth in a different way. I would find it hard to believe that that wasn't venerated and honoured and respected. I think we've lost a lot of that perspective in our culture, and childbirth is an incredibly miraculous and spiritual event, and I personally find it really difficult to understand how we could have taken that dimension out of childbirth. It's quite extraordinary.
Dr. Sarah Buckley, Brisbane-based general practitioner, author and mother of four children. Pain is inherently controversial because it's so multifaceted. And ironically, it's medical research that's complicated our understanding of pain. Recent advances have indicated that the mere expectation of pain can actually trigger a response in the brain, causing intense somatic pain. The implications of such findings are profound for chronic pain sufferers or those nearing the end of life. Professor Sarah Coakley of the University of Cambridge.
I'm often told, for instance, that I am acutely oversensitive. That's always a rather annoying thing to be told, especially as a feminist. But I think that's something to do with my genetic inheritance. But I think it's also to do with my intense interest in religious matters. And I think when physicians are dealing with people who have a long-term pain, and maybe a pain that is tending to death, they ought to ask much more about what this means to the sufferer. What is their hermeneutical framework? What are their religious beliefs? What are the undertakings which make them see it in one light or another? Because this is irreducibly part of what that pain is for the sufferer. When prescribing analgesics, these factors enter in quite extraordinarily, actually.
If pain has psychological, social, emotional, and cultural dimensions, could it also have a moral dimension? Is there something about the experience of pain that we should value?
First, I want to say, as a philosopher of religion, as a feminist, as a priest, I take it for granted that when we confront someone in pain, if there is anything we can do to alleviate this, we should. But this is different from saying that if we had the capacity to anaesthetize all pain, we ought to do so. Because here we hit really complicated moral and medical questions. Physiological pain is there for a reason. It's to tell us that something is wrong. And so the medical system requires that we register pain, otherwise we can't cure people or heal people. So most thinking medics will tell you that even though it's possible that pain can be obliterated altogether, this would be an exceptionally bad thing, not only medically, but also, to come on to my second point, morally. And I take it that this is where the great religious traditions of the world are so illuminating, because they're able to distinguish between pains that indicate to us that something is awry, whether physiologically or spiritually, and pains which are a sign actually of our being stretched and purged and transformed in order to arrive eventually at the ultimate spiritual goal, whatever that is, in the particular religious traditions. It's a very interesting question that you've already raised, whether we can say that pain is ever a good in itself. I think that's a very profound and problematic question. When people have a meaning system that involves eschatological verification, that is, someone who believes that the meaning of life will be discovered after death, then as they approach death, they realize that this isn't just going to be a snuffing out, it's some kind of passage which is of extraordinary spiritual significance, and therefore sometimes they may undergo more suffering because of the significance they impart to this. But at the end of the day, those mystical theologians like the Carmelites are willing to say only the pain that is the sign of complete union with a Christ who redemptively suffers for the world is a good in itself. And even then, it is only a good because it's partaking in Christ's actually leading people into a place of healing.
You've been listening to Encounter on ABC Radio National, and the program today was called Divine Pain. Guests this week were Lynn Haley, Professor Ariel Gluklich, Professor Sarah Coakley, Pandit Rami Sivan, Subhana Barzagi, and Dr. Sarah Buckley. The sound engineer was Michelle Goldsworthy. Special thanks to Claudia Taranto and David Rutledge. For more information and extended versions of interviews, go to the Encounter website at abc.net.au/rn/encounter. You'll also find a transcript of the program, as well as streaming audio and podcast links, so you can listen to the program at any time. I'm Masako Fukui.